This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles. This week, Jonathan Bennett and I talk with Tim Pozar about broadcasting and the Internet. Up next, Floss Weekly is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes security simple for your remote workforce. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 587, recorded Wednesday, July 15th, 2020. Internet versus broadcasting. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Security Scorecard. Security Scorecard helps enterprises manage digital threats with a 360-degree view of cybersecurity health through a single pane of glass. To learn more and sign up for your free account, visit securityscorecard.com/twit. And by LastPass, give your IT department a break and supply them with the tools that really protect your business. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help you. Hi, everybody. I'm Doc Searles. Welcome to Floss Weekly. I'm joined this week by Jonathan Bennett. And our guest is Tim Pozar, who I've known for many years, and it was fantastic. So, Jonathan, do you know Tim? Do you know much about Tim and what Tim's up to and what he's been doing over the years?
Hey, Doc. It seems like the name is vaguely familiar, but until I was doing some prep for the show, I've not been real well acquainted with him. So I'm looking forward to learning kind of some of what his history is and getting to meet him.
Yeah, and you're still in Oklahoma, by the way, I'm sure, right?
Oh, yes. It'll be quite the event if I ever have to drag the laptop out.
There's an Oklahoma item I might bring up on the show. I'm on the set of Knives Out here. That's what it looks like. The movie. It's a borrowed house, a friend in San Marino, California, which is where I'll be for the next several weeks before hopefully going back to New York. So, there we go. I didn't have it open. So this is doing these things live. But we are sponsored, and I'm going to go into the ad and get this thing paid for by people we appreciate and then go into the show. So this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Security Scorecard. Security Scorecard is the global leader in cybersecurity ratings and the only service with 1.5 million companies continuously rated. Their mission is to empower every organization with collaborative security intelligence because you are only as secure as those you work with. They help enterprises manage digital threats with a 360-degree view of cybersecurity health and through a single pane of glass. Their patented rating technology is used by over 1,000 organizations for multiple use cases, including self-monitoring. With Security Scorecard ratings, you evaluate your organization's cybersecurity risk using data-driven, objective, and continuously evolving metrics that provide visibility into your organization's information security control weaknesses. And with third-party risk assessment, instantly view the cybersecurity posture of any third-party vendors, partners, or suppliers to help you evaluate risk in your ecosystem. It can also allow them to find and fix security risks and vulnerabilities across their externally facing digital footprint. They are also used for board and executive level reporting and in the insurance space for cyber insurance underwriting. Security Scorecard non-intrusively collects data from publicly available feeds across the internet for an outside-in perspective. The data is used to calculate scores across 10 key risk factor groups, such as patching cadence, application security, DNS health, network security, and endpoint security. An A to F grading scale helps companies easily recognize and continuously monitor the cybersecurity posture of any organization. Companies with a C, D, or F are 5 times more likely to be breached. So you have to be careful about that. Security Scorecard Atlas is the leading cybersecurity questionnaire and validation solution. It cuts through the questionnaire noise so you can find out your score to make your business cyber secure. Atlas's centralized platform leverages machine learning to automate the cybersecurity questionnaire exchange process for senders and receivers, making it 2 times faster, more accurate, and secure. Atlas is the only platform in the market that instantly maps cybersecurity rating data to individual responses, providing a true 360-degree view of risk. Cut the questionnaire cycle in half, save hours with 20-plus industry-standard questionnaires or their custom questionnaire wizard. Collaborate easily and securely with your team and third parties. Security Scorecard believes that every business has a right to its own cybersecurity rating. They were awarded Best Product Security Ratings by 2020 SC Magazine Awards. The combined power of Security Scorecard Ratings and Atlas gives organizations a 360-degree view of cybersecurity for any company in the world. Sign up for your free account by visiting securityscorecard.com/twit. Check the score of your business and up to 5 others. To learn more and sign up for your free account, visit securityscorecard.com/twit. That's securityscorecard.com/twit. So, welcome to the show, and welcome to Tim Pozar, an old friend from both the broadcasting and the internet worlds. A little background on Tim. Tim works on building infrastructure that enables democratic discourse. He's been building out network infrastructure since the 80s. He's co-founder of a network consulting group called 2P LLC. He also works on San Francisco's community broadband network that provides internet to low-income housing. Recent work under his company includes a high availability emergency network at Burning Man for the BLM and a large fiber network in the San Francisco Bay Area. He also has his own actual licensed radio station in his house in Marin County. And if you live nearby there, you could get it on an actual radio. And he's got great hackage behind that. Also, I've in my capacity as the editor-in-chief of Linux Journal in the past have written about Tim and his work back when he set up, I think, the longest wireless link to using Wi-Fi frequencies between land and sea, way from a TV station site on San Bruno Mountain all the way out to the Farallon Islands. So I haven't seen you yet, Tim, but do I have that right? Is that still in operation and doing what it was supposed to do?
It is. In fact, we just upgraded it about 2 years ago with some Mimosa radios that were kind enough to donate the links to us. And the reason for the upgrade is we upgraded our live camera that we have out there that you can steer around and watch the birds. So there's an HD camera. If you go to the California Academy of Sciences webcams, you can see the Farallon cameras out there.
That is so cool. So when I first met you, I think was at a one of the many ISP kind of cons that they had back in the 90s when ISPs were a new thing and before the phone companies and the cable companies ate that whole world. But I already knew you from seeing your – I think we either had some contact through one of the San Francisco radio stations that I was – hanging out with people that worked at or something, KLOK or one of the ones that followed that or KKSF. I forget, right. but I was surprised. I remember being surprised to find that this guy I knew about from radio was actually not just doing ISP stuff, but was a founding figure in the ISP world. So you want to review for us a little bit of where that, how that overlap worked and how it all happened?
Oh, well, okay. So so the winding way back, I've been very interested in trying to, as you say, democratize communications, make sure that everybody can have their voice heard. Although with Facebook of late, I'm sometimes regretting that. But so I started community radio stations. We started a bulletin board system, or I helped with one called FidoNet, if you remember that way back when. Yeah. I wrote the software to connect FidoNet up to UUCP and Usenet and such, and established an early domain called FidoNet.org, where actually at that point in time, I had to go down to SRI to plead my case to have Fido.net, and they turned it down saying that we weren't a real network. So we had to use that. And that was how you registered domains yeah. back then. Is you went to SRI.
Back when they used to check that stuff.
Yeah.
And I remember a domain, I mean, when I bought Searles.com 1,000 years ago, I guess in 95, something like 95, it was from the Internick or something like that, and I paid $75. We also bought Clutrain.com for $75, so I may have those confused.
It was probably Network Solutions, I think, was one of the first. They kind of took over a lot of that. But this is back when it was a guy that was a handicapped. I think he was blind or something like that. He was hearing impaired. So they had to. We were constantly negotiating over the fact that I really wanted Fido.net, and we wore out several signers, as I remember, during the time, because we were there for hours trying to convince them to do this. But anyway, that was back in the old days when domains were. I should have bought a bunch of domains at that point, but I didn't or got them. After that, did bulletin board systems, as I said. There's this thing called ARPANET, as you probably have talked about on shows and such. And I got the first taste of that with a guy named Eric Fair, who invited me over and gave me an account at UC Berkeley. And I would go over to Evans Hall and log on to one of the terminals there and be able to get experience there. Another person you may know, Dave Taylor, who has, he was a columnist on Linux. Journal.
Yeah, I know. Dave was a very stalwart columnist for Linux Journal for a long time.
Dave and I actually tried to start a company at one point. This is way back when, called Widget Systems. And he introduced me. He was working at HP at that point, and he introduced me a lot to the internet as well. And I said, I got to get on this thing. I mean, this just levels the playing field completely. And so about 1989 or 1990, or actually before then, in the 80s, I've been playing with a packet radio, amateur packet radio. I got my license. I told the folks at the San Francisco Amateur Radio Club, you know, I've been a professional broadcaster long enough. Maybe it's time I become an amateur. they sort of looked at me with disdain.
That's great.
So I've been playing with IP over radio, over AX or AX25. And I said, I got to get connected to this thing. And a couple people put this thing together. Steve Crocker, you probably have heard of that name. John Gilmore, John Romke, who started FTP Software. A bunch of other people basically bought a connection from UUNET. And we sort of cooperatively sort of shared that connection around the Bay Area and started the Little Garden. The reason we called it the Little Garden is because we usually meet at a restaurant called Little Garden in Palo Alto, which has long since disappeared. But that turned into one of the first ISPs, and it was the first ISP that allowed commercial resale. So we had other ISPs connecting to us, much to, Rick Adams' chagrin, because we weren't supposed to do that. We eventually got kicked off of UUNET and became one of Sprint's first ISP customers. So that was overlapping my broadcast career, too. I was I had been in broadcasting since 1974, kind of started as a disc jockey, and then I said, I'm much more interested in the engineering side, and those people don't get fired. So maybe I should become an engineer. And so I did my, several years of college and started, a radio station at my college, which gave me the ability to be able to get be on faculty. So I got free tuition and a parking space, which is a big win at a college. Went for my EE degree at Fresno State there. And then I also helped found another radio station called KFCF, which rebroadcasts KPFA in Fresno. So that's kind of a real short sort of early history. But it was this 6-year overlap from the time that we started Little Garden in like 1990 until we sold it in 96, and that I was still doing broadcasting. And I realized that broadcasting as it was still, even though it's going through this transition with the Telecom Act of 1996, where things were starting to get more centralized. You had, you know, Cumulus and, the other large companies are trying to buy up as many radio stations as possible because it got deregulated. I said, broadcasting is not the place to be if I want democratic communications. So I finally sort of went off and started my entrepreneurial venture of starting internet companies and left broadcasting in 96.
I want to say about the Little Garden. I lived on a peninsula below San Francisco, and it was in San Francisco. And this is if you were dialing into an ISP in those days, this is like the mid-90s, it cost you something. I mean, you had to pay for that. But I wanted to be on the Little Garden so badly. It was just it was really well known as the place to jack into. There were others like, I think, Panics in New York and a few others like that. But right. I had to wait until one called BatNet materialized within the non-toll calling area that I lived in at the time.
Right. That's right. We expected you're going to be dialing from home and not get nailed for the per minute charge on such. And then and then there was, much like FidoNet, I remember people would be looking at all sorts of ways of trying to figure out how to dial into our phone bank numbers and be able to avoid the per minute charges and such. When we eventually went to ISDN, and the way that they rated ISDN is they still had a per minute charge, but if you were in the same CO, you could get away with that because you'd be on the same. There was an ISDN name for it, basically the same.
The CO meaning Central Office.
Central Office, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, phone companies had those.
Well, they still do. They got to put the gear someplace. So.
Yeah. Hey, Tim, I'll jump in if I can. And I'm curious about something. It interests me that I'm younger than both of you guys are, and it kind of interests me that before people born before a certain age that have gotten into kind of our shared hobby and passion, you know, this communication, the internet, technology, it seems like a lot of them got into it through radio. And people that are born later than, I don't know what the year would be, sometime probably in the 80s, some people born later than that year, the internet was there when they, you know, grew up and first started getting interested in it. And I'm curious what you think about this, the idea of radio used to be the gateway drug for people and maybe not so much anymore.
Well, for me, it was what can level the playing field for communications. I know a lot of people who were in the telephone industry that thought that, you know, telephones were the level playing field. And that was the way that they could, create democratic communication. So a lot of people who went into the internet came from the telephone industry. And in fact, they had to use a lot of the existing sort of funky telephone technology like T1s and things like that to be able to connect to the internet and be able to make those connections. So radio was just one place. Certainly telephone industry was another feeder into the community.
Sure. We've used this term a couple of times. Let's go ahead and stop and define it. What exactly do you mean by democratic communications?
Well, so my concern was that if you look at the how press or how communications has sort of existed in throughout history, it's those who own the printing press. You know, Hearst was able to leverage a lot of political clout through his newspapers. It's well documented that he almost started several wars over those things. But and so they didn't have the average person out there basically only had that one pipe. When I grew up, you only had three TV stations and maybe an independent. You may have like four stations in your community. So they had the FCC at that point had to do public. You had to do these public ascertainments, and you'd always the community voices would always be relegated to like 3 o'clock Sunday morning. So that would be the only place where somebody could sort of broadcast and be able to communicate to the rest of the mass, population. In 1940 something, Pacifica started a station called KPFA, and it was meant to open up that pipe to be able to have other voices heard. In fact, during that history, there was many times that they would literally stick a microphone on the sidewalk and let anybody walk up to it and be able to express what they want. I'm not sure if they tape delayed it or what, you know, to keep the words off the air. But that was kind of the thing that sort of like really sort of opened it up for me. That and being able to, as I remember when I was a kid, listening to shortwave and listening to, like Czechoslovakia falling and such. And listening to that over shortwave and saying and hearing that in real time and saying there must be a way to be able to get more voices on the air and be able to get more thoughts out there. When bulletin boards, so community radio, this is why I started, KFCF or helped start KFCF and KFSR, which was Fresno State's radio. But bulletin board systems, when I saw that coming out, FidoNet and such, I said, oh, and particularly FidoNet wasn't just sort of a centralized bulletin board system. It wasn't something you just left a message on one node. You left a message on one node and it would propagate to tens of thousands of other computers out there that were all plugged into the net, much like UUCP. We can talk about that, your Usenet. But it was on a level that you didn't have to go out and spend $100,000 on an HP or a Sunbox or something like that. You could run this on an MS-DOS computer. So that meant that it got it into more hands. There was a point where during apartheid, we weren't supposed to be communicating back and forth between South Africa and the United States at one point or exchanging information, particularly between research and educational facilities. And a group of us said, screw that. That doesn't help in getting other people's voices heard and being able to understand and to break down that wall. So we actually end up putting in kind of a stealth connection between the university in South Johannesburg to a friend of mine's house in Portland, Oregon, to be able to get communications back and forth. And for a long time, a lot of research information went between Lawrence Livermore Labs and through my computer back to university in South Africa. So this is the way that we want to be able to democratize communications, is we want to make sure that every voice gets heard. Now, lo and behold, there's a backlash to that that I had no idea that was going to happen, that people could game this in the way that they did, and particularly in 2016 and before. We knew about flame wars. We knew about people's opinions, but we thought that that was going to be basically self-regulated. But in fact, it's gone beyond that. So we need ways of being able to sort of like, not necessarily govern, but have a kind of a relationship or trust system associated with communication. So you can say to yourself, I trust that's speaker's voice.
Yeah, so that's actually the direction I was going to go with the next question is, we've got even today, so thinking about this idea of democratizing, if you're really willing to embrace that, this idea of free speech for everybody, you kind of run into I guess it's a catch-22. And so what we're seeing today is we've got these big platforms like Facebook, Twitter, and there's this it's happened recently where, you know, someone says something that's far enough off the reservation in one side or the other that, you know, somebody at Facebook or Twitter says, all right, we're going to ban that person. Or, you know, there's even this idea, again, you alluded to it, this person is a bot. You know, it's just somebody working in a troll farm somewhere. I'm curious how this meshes together with true democratized communication. Like, what's the balance between anybody's idea is good to go, and there's some of these things that, you know, for whatever reason are just you can't allow it, or, you know, somebody makes the decisions, you can't allow it. What does the future look like? What do you think the balance is eventually going to fall to?
Yeah, I'm looking back into the old broadcast days too. There was much more responsibility to make sure that the communications that was generated, you know, Walter Cronkite was well respected for having an even-handed presentation of the news, and most news organizations of that era weren't trying to necessarily push an agenda. And so there was a lot of vetting. There's a lot of peer review of the news and such. So there is interest in that until, you know, and I have to say that, you know, political incited or pushed journalism has been around for a long time. I mentioned Hearst.
Sure.
But the mainstream news at least was self-governing enough until they realized that they can actually make more money being not, you know, neutral, but actually being somewhat politically directed left or right or center or whatever, you know, that their audience that they're aiming for. I'm thinking of, you know, people who claim themselves as more entertainers but represent themselves as news as, you know, in not only the right but the left. When you have a completely open system, then, and most, you know, I come from, it's no secret that people like John Gilmore and various other folks are pretty libertarian. And we really struggled with trying to deal with things like spam when we first started an ISP. At that point in time, there was a backlash against spam. Still is. And so there was groups that would put together called real-time black hole lists or RBLs. I'm thinking of Dave Rand in particular. And he, they, this was something that we really struggled because we didn't want to get on these lists, but yet we didn't want to stifle free communications. So I don't want to do that. I want to make sure that people still have a voice, but that there's sort of a trust or authentication associated with that data. So I don't think that basically banning somebody, unless it's really sort of like a criminal intent, is the way to do this. There must be some sort of authentication or not necessarily authentication or reputation system that's associated with the communication so that you can have some confidence that there's maybe some fact in this. Maybe there's some peer review associated with this. Having again, Twitter or Facebook basically shut down accounts, that may not necessarily be criminal, may you're skating the line of censorship at that point. So it's a really hard subject, and we struggled with this in the early years of spam, as I mentioned.
Well, there's so many ways we can go with all of this, but yeah. First, we need to keep paying for this. So I'm going to go to our second ad. So this episode of Floss Weekly is also brought to you by LastPass. Your IT department has a very big job, more devices, applications, and remote workforces, all with new threats and regulations, which make strong security extremely complex. Luckily, LastPass provides your IT with strong security that is easy to use and to manage. You can secure every entry point from shadow IT to apps to mobile and cloud services. Their access services give you visibility and control over every access point to your organization. You can unify access and authentication. Employees access a variety of applications and devices, leading to a lack of visibility of user activity between each of those. LastPass Identity offers a simple and integrated view across all access and authentication tasks so they can see who is accessing what, when, and where. Increase security without impacting productivity. Increase security that slows down employees, hinders productivity, but you can't leave your business exposed. LastPass's authentication solutions enable you to understand user behavior, to adapt authentication based on the user, reducing friction while preventing threats. Make password security effortless. Passwords are entryways into businesses. Spreadsheets and sticky notes aren't secure. LastPass's password management secures them all so you don't have to. LastPass allows employees to do their work securely when in the office or working from home. They won't store your master password, which means hackers can't get to it, and encryption happens exclusively at the device level before syncing to LastPass for safe storage. So only users can decrypt their data. LastPass uses 256-bit AES encryption. That's the same encryption type used by banks and the military, so you know you're getting the most security possible. And we use LastPass here at Twit, so our experience with that is ample, and we're quite satisfied. Secure your business and give your IT department the tools to keep your business safe. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help your business stay productive and secure no matter where your employees are working from. That's LastPass.com/twit. So thanks for that. There are a few loops I wanted to close here. Like, so you mentioned Steve Crocker earlier. An interesting piece of trivia to me is that I think it was John Gilmore, Steve, and Vince Cerf are all parents of the internet, and are all from Van Nuys, California. They're all like went to the same high school. Steve wrote RFC number one, the very first request for comment for the IETF, which is, you know, email, a zillion other things now that are standard, have all gone through that process. And he's a great dude. You know, he's a friend of mine as well. I wanted to mention, just getting back to broadcast for a second, that when I think it's interesting, by the way, the point that Jonathan made about generations. I was a ham radio operator as a kid, and so the only code that I know actually is Morse, which is pretty freaking useless. But I remember the first time that I was in your part of the country in 1963, which may have been before either of you were born. I was a teenager, and two things impressed me that, having come from New York City, that I did not know about the Central Valley. And one was UHF TV. The UHF was already there. It was not in New York. And so everybody's antenna on their roofs, these tiny little things that pointed off in some direction, probably toward a mountaintop adjacent to the valley. I hope I'm still here. My screen disappeared. I am.
San Francisco, Fresno was one of the test beds for UHF. And in fact, there was a couple VHF stations, and they moved them to UHF. So you had Channel 24 and Channel 30 and Channel 47, Channel 53, which was the independent. And so everything was UHF there. And so getting a Sacramento station in Fresno was kind of one of those rare things, because the higher the frequency, the ultra high frequencies, much more difficult to get longer distances. So we would see VHF stations from San Francisco, like Channel 2 and such, bounce in. But the UHF stations for longer distances were difficult.
Yeah, so that was one thing. And the other thing was that my cousins listened to a station called KYNO, which I'm sure you're familiar with. You may have been on it, Kino. Yep. And because they dropped their power at night and went directional, they would say goodbye to Dinuba, where they lived in Orange Cove and Visalia and a bunch of other places. And then it went, there was nothing there. And anyway, that impressed me. Anyhow, I just wanted to mention those things because, you know, we're all creatures to some degree of where we come from. Jonathan, I know you want to get back to some questions, so you can look at the back. Yeah.
This interests me, this idea of a democratized communication and the platforms that we see. I'm curious, are you familiar, have you been watching at all the legal action going on between Patreon and Owen Benjamin, aka Big Bear, the comedian that gets thrills out of skating the line of what's appropriate to say?
No, I haven't. I haven't been watching that one in particular. So they have to fill me in on that one. But
okay, so there's it
sounds like it's a troll.
I would say it's probably safe to say that he is a troll of a comedian. But what happened is essentially he had a Patreon account. People were supporting him there. And Patreon took a look at the stuff he was doing and said, all right, that's it. He's in our mind, he's crossed the line. He no longer can be a part of our platform. And so they banned him from Patreon. And because Patreon is based, and I am not a lawyer. I'm going to flub the description of what's going on here, I'm sure. But Patreon has a forced arbitration clause in their terms of service. And because Patreon is located in California, they're under all of these California laws, one of which being that Patreon is required to pay the arbitration costs up front. And so like 72 of Benjamin Owen's supporters said, we would like to start arbitration because you banned this person that we support. And the upfront costs of doing this is just, you know, it's a lot. It's millions of dollars. And they're trying to fight it in court. And they just got handed a partial ruling that said, no, you probably can't do that. You probably need to pay up on this. And it's really interesting because these consumer protection laws suddenly – they're beginning to put pressure on these big platforms saying, no, you can't just ban people in this opaque way. You have to, you have to be willing to go into arbitration. You have to explain what you're doing. And it's interesting to me to see this shift in the big tech world from the platform owners have total control to, you know, essentially legislators are saying, no, the people that are on these platforms need to have some control as well. And I think it ties in interestingly to this idea of true democracy in communications.
Well, there's a lot of fear. I mean, you've seen this backlash against Facebook and Twitter and being more responsible for how the systems are getting gamed or how they're getting used by various individual players as well as, you know, country players. And they have a lot of sway. So there's a lot of fear in legislation. I, for a short period of time, I was the CTO of the EFF, and I see Doc has his EFF shirt on. Those are the people, there's a reason that the EFF is around is because legislation usually makes bad law. And it was started by, again, a bunch of libertarians, and they wanted to make sure that either the law doesn't get defined or it's very surgical and well thought out. Typically, legislators are very reactive to their constituents and will run something through that's really badly done. Now, if they can take existing laws like you're describing and that are practical, has been well, vetted through, the various decades and such, and be able to apply that to online communities, it's not, keeping in mind Barlow's vision of the cyber universe is international border free, then maybe that can work. And your analogy or your description of what California law has to restrict Patreon to be able to do, maybe that's the way to do it.
I have a couple of thoughts about this. One is that part of the design of TCP/IP and for that matter HTTP is that it's end to end inherently, and it doesn't have to be centralized. I think my own feeling and my own work around this is toward the term democratizing carries with it the assumption of the crowd wins, whereas the more libertarian angle on it, you might say, in a literal sense, is that everybody has agency and everybody can participate, and there's no reason any single person can't be part of something. And you know, so toward that, actually, a group I work with came up with a what you might call an alternative to Patreon, which is called Emancipe. And Emancipe just basically is a simple way that anybody can tip anybody else with code that's independent of any central platform for whatever they like, or can pay whatever they want for whatever they like. And it's an idea we came up with years ago, and I invite readers and listeners, or listeners and viewers, to talk to me about that, because I think there's still a chance to make that happen. I don't think we have. I mean, I think that platforms are inherently an industrial age notion. That's, you know, we always need big companies. There's no doubt about that. We need what only big companies can do. But there's no reason to think we only need them. You know, that as sooner or later everything gets trapped inside a platform, or that's kind of like a roach motel you can go into and never leave. I don't think that's the only choice. In fact, open source was invented to a large degree because of that. Last week we talked about open standards as a way around that as well. You know, but we do need laws. You know, so but I'd rather have the tech start and that's the horse, and then you get norms behind the tech, and then you get the laws behind those. And I think for lack of that arrangement, we have things like the GDPR and the CCPA, which, well-intended as they are, have in some ways made things worse, I think.
Right. I've sort of lost my train of thought there, but your point of the cycle of the tech that gets invented first, and then sort of the norms, and then the standards get into place, or at least, the legislative standards, is the flow that I'd like to see as well. I don't want to see the law out there preventing innovation from happening. So if you restrict this too much to say this needs to get centralized, so then what happens when somebody comes up with a new idea, that they're going to have to go through another series of hurdles to be able to deploy what they're trying to do? There's a friend of mine who's trying to sort of jump on the bandwagon of doing contact tracing for COVID at this point. And they're being bolted into the Android and Apple APIs and regulations and privacies that are kind of restricting their way of being able to invent and be able to innovate their technology. So I'm concerned about that, and that maybe we need to come up with another standard that's outside of what Apple and Android is doing here, but still have a concern for privacy and such.
Tim, I'd like to take something Doc just said and run with it, partially because this is Floss Weekly and open source is really what we care about. But when we think about this idea of, and again, I love it, so I'll follow up on it, democratized communication, which really I think it is the libertarian ideal, as Doc said. It's not so much democracy in the formal sense. Open source has historically and continuing forwards is one of the things that's really enabled this. I mean, so you think about it, if you've been kicked off of a big platform like Facebook or Twitter, well, the open source Apache and the open source PHP language and all of these things exist so that you can go out and very easily build your own platform, host your own platform. All you need is an IP address and a DNS name, and suddenly you are no longer beholden to Facebook. You know, if we're talking about someone that's in a more extreme case than that, you know, there's been a few DNS names that have been pulled off the internet. And what have people done? Well, there's even Tor that people can go and take refuge in and get themselves a .onion address. And, you know, that's all powered by open source. I'm curious what you think about this. Is open source really the answer? Is it the only way to go? I'm kind of convinced that it is. You know, if you really want that ultimate freedom, open source is the only way to do it, because you can't have, to really have freedom of communication, you can't have somebody on top of the platform that can make the decision to be able to ban or to shadow ban or, you know, whatever people come up with. Would you agree with that?
Right. So you're talking about various layers of the OSI stack. And my work has always been in kind of layers 1, 2, and 3, which is making sure that people have connectivity to internet. In other words, IP itself. But a lot of people get confused that they think, you know, Facebook is the internet or whatever. You know, it's that little area is the internet. It's not. There's Discord. There's all these other applications out there that at layer 4 and above that and you have, you know, technology now, WebRTC, which enables basically an open source communication systems, much like Skype or whatever else you want to be able to use, to be able to have a conferencing system. So people are looking at developing that, particularly in this age of, you know, shelter in place where we're having to conference more and they don't want to go through the standard sort of Skype or I'm not necessarily knocking Skype or anything like that, but if there's some concerns about it being centralized or they're having to put their video or their content through servers that they may not necessarily control, there's open source, there's open standards to be able to use. And you reference being able to do a little bit of PHP and putting things up. Well, there's a barrier to entry to be able to know what PHP is, but people like Automattic who publish WordPress, that is so easy to just sort of like pay, you know, $10 a month or whatever and be able to put up a website and be able to publish your material. So yes, I highly endorse open source, particularly at, you know, application layer and above, as being a great democratizer of communications as well.
So there's something else that we've touched on that I've been watching develop with bated breath, and you know, you talk about ISPs and how at one point there were many different ISPs and now they've kind of come together to where there's just a few of them, and we're getting to the point now to where we're getting more options. Starlink is the one that I am very eagerly awaiting, and I think it's going to even the playing field. Not in ways that we've seen before, but there's another way that you talk about internet access that the playing field is not even, and that is rural access. People that are off the beaten path, people that live on an island somewhere. And you guys mentioned this very early on in the episode that you have this ridiculously long Wi-Fi link, which is very impressive. what are your thoughts on Starlink and kind of the, I think, a revolution that it's going to bring about in the very near future?
It's very important in the fact that the alternatives to Starlink has been things like Inmarsat and Iridium and such. And most of those have been, both of those have been either failures, where in the case of Iridium, it had been propped up by the United States government to be able to sort of like have it continue for a while, or Inmarsat, which is very expensive to push data across. So if Elon can drop the cost and increase the bandwidth for areas that are like in the Sierra Nevadas or middle of the Sahara Desert or wherever, then that's a big win for those communities that are so isolated that they don't, that all they get is what communications or what colloquialisms or whatever, you know, the echo chamber that they have locally. They don't get to see other ideas and thoughts. Again, shortwave was kind of the great equalizer in the 60s and, you know, in the 50s and such. VOA and various other people try to leverage that. If he can pull this off, I was just looking at the actually he made an announcement today of how the user unit is going to be able to track the satellites and sort of automatically re-aim the antenna and such. I'm looking forward to it. When our link goes down to the Farallones, they have to pull out an Inmarsat phone, and it costs them quite a bit of money to make a phone call to me to say, "Hey, Tim, the microwave link's down." So it's a short, practical thing as well for us. But I'm very interested. There was a one point in time Obama tried to address rural deployment in the United States with what was called the BTOP effort, which or broadband telecommunications, whatever it was. And he put several billion dollars into that. And a lot of money went into small little ISPs who tried to do the right thing and put microwave links in and be able to address this kind of thing. But a lot of that money just basically sort of got sucked up and then people just sort of ran off with it. So it wasn't that effective. And much like the way that the Payroll Protection Act has been distributed, that a lot of people, there isn't a lot of oversight on this too. So I think government has this responsibility to be able to break down these barriers. My work in the past has been to make sure that we have more competition, even at the city level, within the urban environment. Many towns may only have a cable TV and a telephone company as the two ISP providers, and some may not even have cable. They may just have a telephone company, and they're back to the days where you have to dial in and you don't have broadband because they're too far out for DSL or UVerse or whatever, or Fios. Mm-hmm. So we need to be able to come up with more innovation. My work in the past with urban environments has been to try to get municipalities to think about doing either public or public-private partnerships to open up their manholes, their conduits, their sidewalks or whatever, and put fiber in, and then be able to have any Tom, Dick, or Harriet ISP be able to rent that last mile to get into a prem.
I have a quick question before we get to our final questions, which is that it was a brief story. When my youngest son, who is one of those millennials who grew up with the internet and listened to a lot of radio on the internet, including actual radio stations. There's a station in Boston that's like all a cappella on weekends. He was into a cappella at the time. We were in New York and we'd go to Radio Shack to get a radio for our new apartment. And then Radio Shack didn't have one. And then later there was no Radio Shack. And he asked this question. He said, what's the point of range and coverage? Like, to him, from where he stood, you know, this feature of radio was in fact a bug. And I'm wondering if for the new generation where there's not, you don't embody the inverse square law. We in a vernacular way, we know what the inverse square law is. You get farther away from something, it gets fainter. But on the internet, you're either there or not there. And even with satellite radio, you're listening to something that's 25,000 miles away, like it's nothing. And I'm wondering if we've lost something there. And we need a short answer before we get to the other rest of it, because we're running out of time. So I'm just wondering if you thought about that at all.
Well, I think the inverse of square law is actually isolating communities. So you only got the news for that community. But in a way, that helped build communities as well. So people were more responsible for the community's needs and actions. Whereas if I have an internet radio station, I can't really address the fact that a community has a particular need because I don't know what that is. So we still need localized communications and distributions and responsible parties. And the inverse square law actually enforced that.
Yes. So we have, we close the series of planned questions. One is, what have we not asked you would have liked us to ask?
I think you really touched on the ones that I know that you had a bent on broadcasting, and we can certainly geek about broadcasting for hours and hours and hours, which we did the other day. My big concerns is democratic communications and making sure that we can enforce it well or distribute it well. And so I'm really glad you touched on the new technologies that are coming out, such as Starlink. I'm glad that you touched on open source. Those are areas that I'm less, or at least open source is something I'm less pushing, but I'm more concerned about basically just making sure that the pipe can get to a particular location. And then I know that open source and innovators will be able to fill in that application, those layer four and above, so long as the hard part is the last mile, or and some people call it the first mile. So we need to recognize that that pipe needs to be able to get to someplace for the applications for open source to be able to be effective.
A quick one. Do you have any angle on blockchain?
Well, that's one of those sort of like, is that a troll question too?
Yes, it is.
I have a ball in blockchain right here. Yeah,
it's interesting to boss. I know a lot of people are into it. I've sort of studied it myself, but it's an interesting way of being able to sort of like have a ledger and be able to have some accounting to a ledger. So, you know, everybody has been saying, well, we can track food and supply chain sort of things. But so I'm still looking for kind of the, ignoring, Bitcoin and things like that. I'm still looking for the application for it at this point. And maybe that's trust in communications.
Yeah, yeah. So last but not least, especially for our devoted Floss listeners, what is your favorite text editor and scripting language?
Oh, VI and Bash. Sorry. I'm a
Bash
West
for your
Coast.
Shell. Yeah.
You know, I'm not Emacs. Sorry, Richard. I'm more of a Bill Joy, VI guy.
That's great. Okay, well, this has been fantastic. There's so much more we could talk about. I kind of wish we recorded what we talked about a few days ago. We were geeking out on broadcasting and everything else, but we'll have you back, I'm sure. It's just been awesome having you. So thanks again to Tim Pozar for being on the show, and
thank you.
See you again as soon as possible.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
So Jonathan, how was that for you? How did that go to your expectations and leave you wanting more, or what?
Oh, I try not to have too many expectations when coming on to do a show because everybody is so different. But no, I enjoyed getting to meet Tim. He's a neat guy. He seems like a kindred spirit in many ways. I know we didn't talk about open source software a whole lot, but kind of the philosophy behind it, some of the deeper philosophy about communication and what freedom really looks like in communication, and that's interesting. I'm glad to meet him, and glad that there are people out there that are really stopping and thinking about this and trying to make sure that those first three layers of the USI model are open and free as well. Which, thinking about it, open source sort of predates networking and the internet for sure. But you think about it, the last say 20 years, open source has really exploded in a kind of a worldwide way because the internet exists. And if it weren't for the internet, I think open source would still be a very niche thing that colleges and universities would know about, but probably not the everyday, the everyman.
Yeah, Tim was especially interesting to me because he's one of those people whose work and interests are extremely broad. But also very caring. I mean, he really wants to do good things. I mean, there are an awful lot of geeks that are like, I just want to do cool things. He wants to do good things. And there's so many of us who are also, really brilliant about the one thing that we're known for and that we obsess on. But Tim is all over the place. So it's been, it's been great having him on for that. So for plugs, anything you want to plug?
Sure. So, of course, you can follow me on Twitter at JP_Bennett. And I keep the politics out of that, maybe an occasional philosophical sort of question like what we talked about today. But mainly it's going to be about open source and security stuff. And then go check me out on Hackaday.com. I do a weekly security column there that runs every Friday. And then Tuesday. Tuesday morning, another column that I occasionally runs that I write is Tales from the Sysadmin. And so this time I was talking about what to do when you have a hard drive that's dying and how to use a DD Rescue to be able to get data off of it. And so that's always fun. But check me out there.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. In my case, is just look at what I do. There's a lot of it. And, and get in touch with me if you're interested in any of it. So thanks so much. Next week we have Devin Lofredo of Kid OYO and other things. Devin is doing some amazing work with open source and education. And I don't know what they'll call the generation he's working on, but they are going to save the world. They're really, really smart and good. And he makes the most of it. So thanks, everybody. This has been Floss Weekly, and we'll see you next week.
Be sure to check out the other shows on the network, like my other show, Hands-On Wellness. I love to share different tips and tricks that's going to help you get a better grasp on your personal wellness. Just go to twit.tv/how and subscribe now.